What did people say about women? And there are books of compilations of that sort of thing. What did Augustine say about women? What did Benedict say about women? What did so-and-so, so-and-so, and so-and-so say about women? That's one approach. It's not primarily the one we're going to take today. Another one is to look at femaleness and the symbolic value that's given to femaleness. That's also not what we're going to do today. Today we're going to look at women's activities and opportunities, the things that they did or could do or couldn't do. I'm going to go very fast. This is like a Learjet view of 2,000 years, although Rick was teasing me that I was almost getting up to his speed because he does millions of years in an hour. Only 2,000 years. It should be a snap. But please stop me if you have questions as we're going along. I'm certainly happy to stop and take a little detour and go off in a direction that interests you as we're going along. First of all, I want to distinguish something for you between sex and gender. It won't come into this a lot, but it's an important reason that we need to study the history of Christianity and the history of women, is that we can study about women, okay, which is a biological category, right? There are this kind of people and that kind of people, and except in a few rare cases, it's pretty obvious, pretty fast, which is which. Gender, however, is a much more dynamic category, and particularly American students of this emphasize it's a cultural, social category. It's what we expect from people who are male and people who are female. And one of the examples I find useful with students is to say, think about Louis XIV, or even think about Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson and the way they dressed. They had long wigs, powdered. They wore short pants, silk stockings, and high heels. And that was very masculine, right? Now, if Steve came walking in here with long curly hair, silk stockings, and high heels, you would think, oh, well, he's from the Bay Area, you know. But you might not think it was very masculine. Our notions of what is appropriate for men and women in our context shift. And religion is one thing that influences very, very much what is appropriate behavior, attitudes, activities. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, but just to alert you to the fact that that changes over the last 2,000 years. But I think all of those kinds of expectations are layered in our brains. And we have all of them, or in our, I don't know where it is, but somewhere. We have a bunch of expectations. The ones from the early church, where we hear someone like Tertullian calling women the gateway to hell. We have the ones from the 19th century where we're told that women are more moral and more religious than men. And we have the ones from the 1950s from Leave It to Beaver, and we have the ones from the 1960s, and they're all mixed up inside of us. And perhaps knowing about how that has happened can help us get a new vision. Now, as we have begun to uncover the history of women in the church in the last 25 years, we've gone through several stages. The first stage is sometimes called the history of horrors, the history of atrocities. And that sometimes comes with that attitudes about women. All the terrible things that the church has done to women. Witch hunts, keeping women out of leadership positions, not letting them talk, making them feel unclean, having to have a purification rite before you can come back into the church after you have a baby. That's one phase. The next phase is sometimes called add women and stir. You just add some women to the story, but it doesn't really change the story. Or some have called it the search for an alternative tradition. That's kind of where we're going to be today. And then a third stage that we anticipate is having a new way of looking at the past, so that we don't have to say, what were women doing 2,000 years of Christianity, but that the story just naturally includes both men and women, just as the congregation includes both men and women. So that what we find in books and in our stories reflects what we see around us and what our ancestors saw around us. Let me, one little detour about history. History is, in a way, a family story. It does not necessarily have to be the history of your biological or household family. History is a way that we appropriate stories to our own. I don't know about you, but I certainly didn't have any relatives around at the Mayflower, right? Or the first Thanksgiving, but that's part of my story because I'm an American. I can't trace my bloodlines back to Jerusalem, but that's my story because I'm a Christian. So all of that becomes our story, even if we don't have bloodlines. It's our spiritual history that we're connected to. Okay. Couple more introductory or preliminary remarks. Is history subversive? I think the history of women in the church can very much be subversive. One way it's subversive is it can make people really angry, especially when we do the history of horrors. And I find that with my students sometimes, that they get really angry and mad, either because of what they're reading or because they read and say, why didn't anyone ever tell me this before? Why have I had to wait so long to find out about these people? It also can be subversive or eye-opening because it connects us. Makes us, well, I saw this happen last week. It's wonderful. On Tuesday night, we had a meeting with the title, Can Feminists Go to Church? And there were a number of women there. And one woman was so in pain. I came back, I said to my friend, that woman was just bleeding all over the floor. She was so in pain about the church, about Christianity, about a variety of things. And I knew exactly what she was saying. She felt like an outsider in the church. And I also knew what we were going to do the next day in my session about Vita Scudder. And I saw her take that paper and read where Vita Scudder said, an early 20th century figure, a creed is not an imprisoning wall, it's a gate opening into a limitless country that I am just entering. And I could see the woman just go, I'm not by myself. History can do that for us. Thirdly, it can create a new vision. And that's kind of what I hope to do, to give us a new vision, not only of the past, but also of the future. Okay, today, as I said, we're going to focus primarily on the activities of women. I think these can help us to form new patterns for understanding Christian life and work. Let me give you, from my own work, an example in this volume, Serving the Word, Lutheran Women Consider Their Calling. They said to me, like in May, by September 1st, could you write a little essay about the history of Lutheran women from the Reformation to the early 20th century? And I said, well, excuse me, but it's all in primary research stage. So what I did instead was to talk about ministry under four categories. The ministry of women as administrators, as hostesses, as patrons, and as teachers. Those are all gifts that Paul talks about in the New Testament. But they aren't necessarily categories we always use to talk about ministry. So let's start. If this sparks your attention and you want to read some more, I've got bibliography here. I'll refer to it as we go along. These first two here especially are general works. The first one, Her Story by Barbara McAfee, is a green cover. It's available in the bookstore, as is Serving the Word. It's a synthesis, bringing together a lot of work that's been done in the last 25 years and has excellent bibliographies. So if you want to do a self-teaching course on the history of women in Christianity, that's where I would tell you to start. Because if you read that and follow the bibliographies, you'll know as much as anybody. The second volume here, Women of Spirit, edited by Rosemary Ruther and Eleanor McLaughlin, is one of the first things that came out. It's one of the first things that I read. It's several essays from the early church up till the 70s and some of the ordination struggles, particularly in the Episcopal Church. And that is also very good, but it's early, so the bibliographies aren't so useful. Okay, launching in. The early church. Maybe this is what you've heard the most about because we think about women in the Bible, women in the New Testament. One of the scholars who's really opened up the history of women in the early church is named Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza. And her big earth-shattering book is called In Memory of Her, the references to Mary of Bethany, who anointed Jesus' feet. Fiorenza and other scholars of the early period of the church, what Fiorenza calls the community of Jesus' followers, have emphasized for us, first of all, that women were evangelists, that women had an extremely important and active role as carriers of good news. And we can all think of examples of that from the New Testament witness, the woman at the well, who goes into town. And then the person we look to most frequently, Mary Magdalene, sometimes called the apostle to the apostles, because it was Mary Magdalene at the tomb who went back and told the apostles what she had seen. We also know from some other evidence, Gnostic Gospels, that didn't make it into the New Testament, that the role of women in the community of Jesus' followers was contested. And there was tension about Mary Magdalene and some of the other women and what they were going to do. And particularly it seems from that witness to have been between Mary Magdalene and Peter, a kind of like this, that Peter didn't really think that Mary Magdalene had an important role to play. But Mary Magdalene has risen very much in recent years in the Christian community to a position of more prominence as one who made a clear testimony. Recently, I've also come to appreciate Martha from the John account and her confession of Jesus. If we look in Romans, we find, as Fiorenza has pointed out, a list of women, not too much about what they did, but a list of women like Junia, like Persis, who Paul describes as our sister in the Lord who has labored long. So we know she was doing something. Priscilla, who together with her husband Aquila were traveling missionaries. So this is one thing that women were doing in the early church. They were speaking the gospel. They were teaching, and they were traveling around to do that. A second thing that they were doing is that they were leaders in the house churches. Two examples of that. One is the mother of John Mark, who seems to have been very important in one of the house churches in Jerusalem. And the second is Lydia, who you may remember from Sunday school, was a dealer in purple. She was a businesswoman. Legend says she was the first convert on the European continent. And as a wealthy woman, she was a patron of the house church. A more difficult question about the early church is this thing that we call deaconess, Phoebe. Fiorenza and others have said that Phoebe has been misserved by being called a deaconess, that we've become confused about what she actually did, because later, not in those first decades, but later, a deaconess was someone whose work was only with women. But the descriptions that we get in the New Testament, particularly, of course, by Paul, of Phoebe suggest that she was a minister to the whole church. So if people talk to you about deaconesses in the early period of the church, be skeptical. It seems to be something that developed later And that in the first few decades, someone like Phoebe was a deacon, as someone like Stephen might have been, who was working with the whole church. Okay. One of our most beloved stereotypes, I think, of the early church is that it was a church of martyrs, a church under persecution. And I remember from Bible camp, we would play these games about being in the early church and having to run and hide from the Romans and do little secret symbols to identify ourselves to each other. It's a little bit overblown. It wasn't always and everywhere in those first 2.5, 3 centuries dangerous to be a Christian, but it was occasionally and in some places dangerous to be a Christian. And perhaps what's most significant about that is that the martyr, the witness who is faithful to death, became an ideal of holiness. The martyr was an ideal of holiness in part because that witness, enduring till death, imitated Jesus and did what Jesus did. Okay. Martyrdom is an equal opportunity form of holiness. It wasn't more open to men or women. Straight across the board, anyone could be a martyr. All they needed was courage and endurance. And one of the more famous and interesting of the martyrs, for whom we still have individual records, is a woman named Perpetua. Perpetua was the daughter of a Roman official. She lived in North Africa, which I think is important to point out about the early church, that North Africa was one of the strongholds, and that most of the early theologians of the church were Africans, Augustine, Cyprian, Tertullian, Athanasius. They were all North Africans, and so was Perpetua. Although she probably was, a colonial, much like the British in India. She was converted to Christianity. Her family were not Christians. And the way we know about Perpetua is this: we have an incredible thing, her own account of her imprisonment. Called The Passion of Perpetua and Felicitas. Felicitas was one of her servants. That's one of the reasons we know that she was a relatively aristocratic woman, is that she had this servant. At the beginning of the document is an introduction, and at the end is a conclusion somebody else added that tells about their actual death. You can read the document in a book called Lost Tradition, which is edited by Patricia Wilson Kastner. It's also available in other editions. Women who were martyrs transcended the fact that they were women. And in the Passion of Perpetua, it's real interesting. One of the things it seems to show to me is that, at least for her, in that extreme circumstance, her notion of gender-appropriate activity was much more fluid than ours is. She had vision of herself wrestling, anticipating her death, in which she appeared to herself as a man, and then she was transformed back into a woman. She was described by the editor of her, her passion as the bride of Christ, or the sweetheart of God. And that was not an obscene notion to them. It was an indication of real intimacy and closeness and her imitation. Students always have a real hard time with this, as most of us would, because dying, that doesn't strike us as a really attractive alternative. I'm not sure it's a model that I want to adopt for my holiness. Let me be so holy that I'll endure until a violent death. But Perpetua was taking a model that was offered to her. It was important in her culture, it was important in her time, and she went to her death with a great deal of dignity and confidence, And the editor tells us that she put up her hair. She didn't want it falling down because that was a sign of mourning. And she didn't want the crowd to think that she was sad about what was happening to her. Slightly after Perpetua, we have another thing that women were doing. And a good place to find out about this is in Rosemary Ruther's essay in Women of Spirit. She talks about a group of Roman matrons. Here we have to know a little something about the culture. Roman marriage patterns in the second and third century were such that young girls, 14 maybe, were married to men about their father's age. That meant they became widows very early in life. Right? And then there they were. They had done their piece for the empire. They'd had their three children. And they had money. And many of them, and I can't tell you proportions, but a significant number were attracted to then growing Christianity. This is around maybe 250 up to 300, just in the time when Christianity is occasionally under persecution, but also growing. And these Roman matrons would gather together to study. We know this because, for example, they corresponded with Saint Jerome, the man who translated the biblical text into Latin to make the Vulgate edition. We have Jerome's letters to them. We don't have their letters to Jerome. But Jerome writes back to them about their questions of translation and interpretation in the Bible. And sometimes he complains, oh, you keep asking me all these hard questions and I have to go and do this research and, oh, you know, it's so much work to study with you women. They had leisure to study. They had people to take care of them. But they did not all stay women of leisure. Some of them adopted an ascetic life. So they didn't stay just patrons of young theologians like Jerome. Some of them, particularly a woman named Millinia the Elder and Paula, went on tours. By this time, there were famous ascetic hermits, both men and women, although we tend to call them the Desert Fathers. There were at least an equal and probably a greater number of women living off in the Egyptian desert, modeling a new kind of holiness, not martyrdom. Martyrs were called red martyrs, and then this other thing that was called white martyrs, in contrast to bloody martyrs. And Millinia and Paula both went on tours. They saw that, these people living in the desert by themselves, praying, denying anything physical. We have records of the things they said. We know that, for example, they would not wash, eat badly, try not to sleep, anything that would tie them to this world, because they're trying to transcend this world and get to be more like God and closer to God. But with someone like Paula, we have the very beginnings of another kind of monasticism. There are primarily two kinds of monasticism. This one kind where you're a hermit, and another kind where you live in a community. Paula and Millinia both founded communities in the Holy Land. They're very interesting because, unlike our contemporary notions about monasticism, these were houses of men and women, not together, but parallel. So they lived in the same area, and they maybe shared a chapel. Okay. Both of them founded kind of dynasties of, for example, the reason we call Millinia the Elder is because her granddaughter came and took over the leadership of the convent. About the same time, a kind of downside for women is that the church is, how do we say it, becoming more rigid. The church is becoming more systematized. And sociologically, this is not surprising. There tends to be a sort of rhythm in social movements, that there's a period of effervescence and excitement and trying new things, and then a period when you try and figure out how to transmit it and how to preserve it and how to keep it going. Now, there's some other things that were going on as well. As the church became more adapted to its culture, as the church came to terms with the fact that it didn't look like Jesus was coming on Thursday, trying to figure out how to keep things going. A piece of that was a growing expectation that leadership in the priestly sense would accrue to men, and particularly that it would accrue to celibate men. Okay. It does a couple of things for women. One, it removes them from certain kinds of leadership, official leadership positions. We're not sure that that was always the case. Dorothy Irwin, an archaeologist, has discovered a very early mosaic that appears to depict a woman celebrating communion. You know, and she does this by the slant of the shoulders, the kind of headdress, etc. So it really looks like that was the early tradition. But once the expectation is that only men will be priests, women lose that official position. Once the expectation is that these will be celibate men, there's no, I call it quasi-professional role for women as the wife of the priest. And once all the priests are supposed to be celibate, they also don't have the experience of living in a family. And there tends to be a kind of misogynism that creeps in, misogynism meaning women hating. I say this begins to be the expectation. It's in the 300s that we have the first decree from a church council that says all priests should be celibate. They come up every now and then. And you know, if you're parents or if you have any role of authority, that usually you keep saying things over and over because people aren't doing it, right? They don't give us those little announcements in the dining hall about how to clear our tables because we've been doing it right. They tell us because we've been doing it wrong. And that's an indication that although the ideal that was being set up was for celibate men to be the priests, that wasn't always the case. The part that wasn't the case is that frequently the men were not celibate. So the women who the women who lived with them had no legal status. And that's another difficulty about that arrangement. Okay. That's not to say that nobody got married, right? Not all men were priests. But another interesting thing that happens as we move from the early church into the medieval church, the 400s, the 500s, the 600s, and I call it evangelism by matrimony, happens particularly among the ruling classes. Let me give you two examples of it. The first is Clovis, the king of the Franks, who around 500 married a Burgundian princess named Clotilde. Clotilde was already a Christian. And one of the things that she did was work very hard to convert Clovis to be a Christian. And that changes the course of Christian history because it shifted some power balances in the Germanic tribal structure. Now, and we can trace this northward as this family sends a daughter to marry into this tribe. Then that tribe, amazingly, soon after, is Christianized. And it goes north. Peter Brown has written about this, as have some others. We can see it coming up a century later in Britain, when Augustine of Canterbury is sent out as a missionary to Britain, and he gets there, and there's Queen Bertha, married to the King of Kent, and she's a Christian. He's not. She is, and she becomes a patron to Augustine of Canterbury. So this is one way that women contributed to the spread of Christianity, primarily aristocratic women. It's easier to find out about aristocratic women than it is about peasant women, of course, because they're more likely to come into the record somehow, even if it's not because of something they wrote down. They're just because we tend to think of what's worth recording as the people who have power. They had some power because they were in those families, which reminds me, one of the things I want to say is that biology and gender are not the only things that define us. And as we study history, one of the things that I always emphasize with my students is that we have multiple bases of identity. If we're studying women or if we're studying men, we have to ask, what are the decisive things for this person's identity? Is it more important to know their class? Is it more important to know where they lived? If I say I'm a 20th century woman, that tells you some things. But you probably also need to know that I'm a Christian. You probably also need to know that I grew up in the Midwest, but I've lived in California. You know, that I have this sort of mixed geographic background. There are lots of little pieces of things that define us. And if we look at someone like Bertha of Kent, we need to recognize that she's not everybody. She's not all women. She's an aristocratic woman. And that's primarily who we find out about. An interesting study of that has been done by someone named Susanna Wempel about Frankish society. Okay, what were some of the other medieval options? So we move from the early church into this huge thousand-year period that we call the Middle Ages. Maybe when you were in elementary school, they called it the Dark Ages. We don't call it the Dark Ages anymore because a lot was really going on. It's not as though it was all night. A lot was going on. It was different, particularly in the first few centuries. There's a kind of transition period. And that's real interesting when we study women because we tend to find, it's a fascinating thing, that the periods of time that historians have been real interested in about men are the most boring times if you're interested in women. Joan Scott wrote an essay called Was There a Renaissance for Women? And she says, you know, the Renaissance was really bad for women. It's these other times that seem to be better. Okay, some medieval options. One option for a woman in the medieval time who was a Christian was to live in a Benedictine monastery. Monastery is a general term. It's not necessarily gender specific. She could be a member of that. It meant that she would not get married, which maybe in our era we think, oh, well, that's not so great to have to join a monastery and not have a family. But it was really the only way to get out of having a family, which was very dangerous in those days. Very dangerous childbirth. It also meant she was more likely to have access to education. She would have time to pray. She would be able to cultivate her own holiness. That model of the white martyr, or the holy person who is ascetic and disconnected from this world, continued. In the Benedictine rule, it's more moderate. Benedict's rule is a wonderful, wonderful example of community life, because he has this great view, very realistic. He says things like, the young monks should not be allowed to sleep near each other. They should sleep between the older monks, lest they not wake up for prayers in the middle of the night. If you live in a colder climate, you should wear more clothes in the winter. So he was willing to adapt to the situation. Benedictine monasticism was one option for women, and particularly women from families like Bertha's family could become abbesses. Frequently a monastery might be founded so that a daughter could become the abbess. It was a way of keeping the land in the family. Land equaled wealth in those days. And that's the cynical side of it, of course. The other side of it is, you found a monastery, and that's a good work. And people will be there praying, and the world will be a better place. The motives were undoubtedly mixed. Who of us has ever done anything for pure motives? Maybe once in a while we have a few brief moments where we do something entirely from pure motives, but most of the time our motives were mixed, and I think it's not unlikely that that was the case in those days. A couple of examples from this period of abbesses. Well, one example, Hilda of Whitby. She functioned almost as a bishop. And we have medieval representations of abbesses with a crook. The bishop's crook. In part, that's because there are two systems of organization in the church at this time. There's the monastic system and the papal system, and they're both developing and they overlap. And in the monastic system, the abbess or the abbot, which also means father, just as pope means father, was in charge of that community. So the abbess was in charge of her community. She heard confessions. She probably occasionally taught, whether or not that was preaching. She could not administer the sacraments. She voted in church councils, and that's why I mentioned Hilda of Whitby. There was a very important synod in Whitby around the 600s about whether or not British Christianity would follow Rome or the Irish system, which endured from the Roman era. Hilda voted with the losing side. She wanted to go with Ireland, but she voted. It's incredible. She voted. That's like if she'd voted in Vatican II. I mean, it's just amazing to me. And in part, it's because she was an aristocrat. And in part, it's because she had a church office. But that option was available. Also in the monastic context, another option, which sometimes went along with being an abbess or being a member of a community, was mysticism. The medieval period is filled with mystics, and they too are enjoying a revival of contemporary interest. People who view their Christian life, the goal, as a kind of union with God. And women are well represented among this category. People like Hildegard of Bingen, who you may have heard of. Over in the bookstore, there's a lovely color volume reproducing her drawings of her visions. And they're just incredible. She also wrote music. People like Catherine of Siena, who was a visionary and, real interesting, an important critic and reformer of the church. Catherine of Siena lived during the time, which you may remember from your world history classes, when there was a pope in Avignon instead of in Rome. And Catherine of Siena was one of the people who worked very hard to get the pope to come back to Rome. She was a correspondent and confidant of important church leaders. I wore my t-shirt today that is inspired by medieval mysticism, Lidwina and the Myroblites. Lidwina was a Dutch woman, and we don't know a lot about her. She's not a major figure, but her mystical experiences happened after she had a skating accident. And Myroblites are a particular kind of mystic. They're people who have miraculous excretions. I know it sounds really strange, doesn't it? They would get oil, healing oil, coming out of their fingers. Something like that. They're strange to us. And we don't want to just be like them. But there are things about them that we may find very enlightening, that may make us wiser about being Christians. some people who have written about that. Carolyn Bynum in particular has written, that's where this t-shirt came from. I was in a reading group with some other faculty, and we read Carolyn Bynum's book, Holy Feast, Holy Fast. And when we got done, we made these t-shirts and sent one to Carolyn Bynum because we had liked her book so very much. But there we saw another way of being Christians, and a way that emphasized particularly, and this is real interesting, I think, in view of what people are saying about women's spirituality in the 20th century, the suffering of Christ. And that it was in the human suffering of Jesus that we are most able to know God. And that was part of the reason that these women, this particular group of mystics that Bynum writes about, had different kinds of fasts. Because in their hunger, in their own suffering, they would be closer to Jesus, and it would prepare them to do two things. One, to feed others, whether it was miraculously or in reality by buying bread and giving it to people. Elizabeth of Hungary, for example. And by not eating, they were prepared to feast on the Eucharist. Okay. Now, I don't expect to eat the wafer and taste blood. Okay. Some of those women did. They weren't given wine, they just tasted the blood. But what I can learn from them is something about the unity of all action and the way I eat and how that affects my relationship to the world and my relationship to God. Another important mystic who to us looks less bizarre is Julian of Norwich, and she's another one you may have heard of. Julian of Norwich lived in England right around the 1400s. She had a set of visions called the Showings. Again, if you check in the bookstore, there's a little book of meditations based on Julian's showing. She was a wise woman. She lived by herself in a room in the parish church in Norwich, and people would come to her to be advised, to be taught. We also remember Julian because she's one of the medieval theologians who helps us to understand how our notions of being woman can influence our understanding of deity. And she's really interesting because she uses that feminine, what for her was culturally appropriate female behavior, to understand Jesus. Not the creator, not the sustainer, but Jesus. She writes about our mother, how Jesus is like our mother and like our father. And she puts the two together, balancing each other out. That's one of the things real interesting about the medieval theological tradition. It's again, they're much less rigid in their understanding of femininity and masculinity and how to apply those not only to God but also to self. Bernard of Clairvaux, who was an early Cistercian, writes about the abbot, word that means father, as being a mother to the other monks. And that's his role. Part of that, and I should feel a little bit of a detour, part of the reason for that has to do with their biology. They understood that mother's milk was processed blood somehow. And so in their minds, again, I'm hesitant to say this, don't just go, oh, yuck, right? Try to imagine how this would have seemed if you didn't know, if you thought that milk came from blood and you saw mothers feeding children and you saw paintings of Jesus with wounds, bleeding, to give life. It mushed together. So that we read this astonishing material about being fed at the wounds of Christ as a child nurses at its mother's breast. Seems kind of odd to us at first, but if you let go and kind of say, oh, okay, I'll think about that. There's a certain logic to it. Okay, could be a Benedictine, you could be a mystic, either in community or in a hermit kind of situation. Around the 1100s, a new option appeared called the Beguines. This tended to be among middle-class women. 1100, we're starting to have urbanization. Feudalism is falling down. People are moving into towns. They don't have as much money. It took a lot of money to open a Benedictine convent, and it may have taken a lot of money to join. You had to have a dowry, just like getting married in some of those convents. Beguines were women, and there was also Begards, but a smaller group of men, who are best described by what they weren't. Okay, they weren't nuns. They didn't have a rule or a constitution. They didn't take permanent vows. They didn't wear special dress so that you could tell who they were. They weren't under special protection of any male religious authority. They were in groups of anywhere from 2 to 100s. And they supported themselves by the work of their hands. They were frequently weavers or manuscript copiers. And they wanted to live a holy life. They prayed together. They're frequently associated with Dominicans or Franciscans, groups that were just starting at that time, particularly Dominicans, and some of them were mystics. They were very frightening to some religious authorities, not all religious authorities, but to enough religious authorities that by 1300 they were condemned, and there weren't supposed to be any more Beguines, because they might get out of control. They might not have enough money. Some of them were, in their mysticism would go astray, or people were afraid their mysticism would go astray. And in some cases, that happened. I mean, we have notorious cases of that, but not all of them. What happened to the women who were Beguines when they were condemned? Some joined Dominican monasteries. Okay, Dominican monasteries. The only thing about Dominicans, you know that they're not supposed to be monks. They're supposed to be something else. But Dominican women were in convents. Some just went on, sort of quietly, and some were killed. And we have examples of Dominicans who were burned at the stake and so forth, because we're moving into the period of time of the witch hunts. Some continued, and there were Beguines, particularly in the Low Countries, the Netherlands, for example, until the early modern period. But they tended to be, by that time, sort of more like the Red Cross or something. Okay, they were doing good works. There were lay women, of course, right? Women who lived at home, women who went to Mass every day. If they were noble women, they maybe were patrons of the church. If they had money, maybe they commissioned for themselves books of days, which were devotional books, very like what was used in the monastery, so that they could pray along with the same patterns that were going on. I probably should say something about someone like Joan of Arc and the repression of women, particularly in the witch hunts. It's a difficult, difficult topic. It's a very painful topic. And there are a lot of theories about why it happened in the late medieval period, what was going on. It's difficult stuff to read. We have a handbook from some Dominican inquisitors about how to find witches. And one of the questions is, why are women more likely to be witches than men? Because they are more carnal, because they're more stupid, because they're more this, and I mean, it's just there, flat out. And it's awful to read. It makes you think, oh, you know, how did any women ever survive, if that's what people thought? Why did they think that? Well, there are a lot of reasons. Anne Barstow is working on the witch hunts, and she has some social ways of looking at it. It's a time of transition. I thought of her as I read this summer. We've had some really gruesome racial violence incidents in the Twin Cities, and in Minneapolis, St. Paul, we can say we're still shocked when that happens. And like when I lived in Chicago, we went, oh yeah, well, it's Chicago. least in the Twin Cities, we still go, ugh, can't happen here. I mean, why does it happen? Maybe it's a time of transition and we strike out. And the people who were prosecuted and frequently executed as witches tended to be outsiders. They tended to be women who were widowed or old or healers, midwives, people who knew about using herbs for healing and that sort of thing. Anne Barstow has also written about Joan of Arc, if you're interested in her. Okay, anything else about the medieval period? Oh, yes. Medieval women's visionary literature, edited by Petroff. If you're interested in this medieval period and the things that women wrote, Hildegard, Julian, etc., that's a very good collection with excellent introductions to the excerpts. Okay. Leaping quickly ahead to the Reformation period. Was there a Reformation for women? You have to ask that question, just like, was there a Renaissance for women? The Reformation certainly changed many women's lives. And I think it's a toss-up whether it made life better for women or not. To ask that question, was it good for women? We have to ask, first of all, how was a good life defined? What did the culture think good life was? And then, what kind of access did women have to it? Because even in the Reformation, things like individual autonomy weren't a big deal. I've done some study of Norwegian peasant culture. And I always have to keep reminding myself that if you're living up on the edge of a fjord with a mixed economy, a little fishing, a little farming, a little dairying, to make a go of it, no one could do that by themselves. And so the fact that all women were expected to get married has to be, and to have children, has to be seen in an entirely different light than it's seen in 20th century America. Because one person can't survive economically in our culture, maybe better or less than a family. So if we want to say, was the Reformation good for women, we have to say, what did the Reformation think good was? And then, what kind of access did women have to that good life? One of the things that the Reformation did, Roland Bainton has emphasized this a great deal, is to spiritualize the home. And I think, in large degree, that was an advantage for women. To say that the family life was not second best. Family life was a good option. But, that's the upside. The downside was there were no other alternatives. Okay. At least in the Catholic tradition, prior to and after the Reformation, maybe family life was second best, but there was this first best, which was to be a nun. So there were at least two options. Being a wife and a mother got more credit, but there were no alternatives. So there's an upside and a downside. And by the end, you'll get the idea, I think, that I think the whole story is upside and downside. I have asked often on my final exams when I teach the history of women in Christianity, a question like this: do you think Christianity has been more beneficial or more detrimental to women, and why? And it always comes out 49-51, you know, or 52-48, or pretty close, with three or four people who say, well, it's really hard to say because there's this and then there's this. The Reformation gave women an educational opportunity to a point. You need a little background for that to make sense. I said in the medieval period, joining a Benedictine monastery gave women the advantage of education. Education in the early and middle ages took place almost entirely in monastic setting. In the late Middle Ages, the university is born. And universities were male institutions. which meant women didn't have access to education and to theological education. That what had been a good place to be educationally, the convent, became a less good option. The Reformation did not give women access to university education, but particularly among Protestants, the Reformation put a strong emphasis on the need to know about what you believed. And that meant that to a certain point, girls were given education as they had not been given education before. The spiritualization of the home generally had a clerical piece to it, which is the return of the quasi-professional role of the pastor's wife. And there we have, in the Lutheran tradition, Katie von Bora, Katie Luther. She'd been a Cistercian nun. She was very well educated. She knew a lot. It's wonderful to read Luther's letters to Katie. They're funny. They're really funny. But there's also, in that laughter, a great deal of respect for what she could do. And he'll say things like, what you're saying is not what you learned when you read John the Evangelist, which tells us she was reading John the Evangelist. She knew about these things. The upside to that is that women had what I call, again, a quasi-professional role. That becomes real important when we come to the modern period and America. And I'll tell this now in case when I get to America, I'm going really, really fast. I think frequently about many pastors' wives, and I have to be sure and say not all pastors' wives fall into this category, not all of them wanted to, as being like Eleanor Roosevelt, who one American historian has said, Eleanor Roosevelt created the job of the vice president. Before Eleanor Roosevelt, the vice president had nothing to do except wait for the president to die. After Eleanor Roosevelt, the vice president's job is to do what Eleanor Roosevelt did. Okay? So I think, in many ways, pastors' wives developed the role of the associate pastor. That's what they did. I think I'm going to leave the modern period. The modern period is probably more familiar to you. Let me just give you some places to look if you're interested. Women of the Reformation by Roland Bainton, biographies, Jane Jemsey Douglas on Calvin. Here are some really interesting studies of the modern period. The Politics of Domesticity by Barbara Epstein and Dimity Convictions by Barbara Welther. If you're interested especially in Lutheran women's history, I will recommend what is in print, which is my book, called From Our Mother's Arms, A History of Women in the American Lutheran Church. It is limited to that body and its predecessors in its specifics, in its generalities. I think it applies pretty much across the board. So thank you for your patience. I'm sorry I couldn't go through the whole thing.